Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hey.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm still kicking, you know?
Yeah, same.
So what's up this week? What do you got for me?
I have some stories for you that, while I was researching them, actually gave me some chest pain. So,
really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're talking about cave diving. And
oh, right.
Yeah. While I was researching, I actually had to take a beat and be like, why do I feel like my chest hurts right now? And then I realized it's because I was incredibly anxious. Because I'm claustrophobic and I'm terrified of cave diving. And I didn't think that it was affecting me really until I actually physically had a sensation that was like a physical manifestation of anxiety. So turns out I am still claustrophobic.
Wow. Imagine that.
Yep.
I don't know. I feel like I'm not to where you're at, but I get like that feeling if I imagine myself in a cave.
Sure.
You know?
But before we get into potentially chest pain causing stories, why don't I tell you about our Patreon? Because bonus episode number 52 poll is up now, which means that bonus episode number 52 will be out soon. So if you want access to all of our bonus content, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. It's a really good time. You won't regret it. But that's all I really have to say about that. So why don't we jump into our stories today? Because I've got three for you.
You have multiple.
I have multiple.
Okay. So this is a cave dive extravaganza.
Kinda, one could say.
Documenting the insanity
that
is cave diving. And shout out, if you're a cave diver, do your thing.
Yeah.
But you have to admit, it's a little nuts.
It's a little scary.
Yeah, I want to know what it would feel like to just be drawn to this like weird unknown.
Right.
Like it's not the ocean and it's not space or the sky. It's like just underwater.
This weird other thing.
But on land, underwater.
Yeah, well, because you have caving, which is just like regular cave exploration, which is still terrifying. But this is specifically cave diving. So it's doing all that scary shit, but underwater, which is even more dangerous. So I feel like these are even a different breed of people than just cavers. They didn't find the tight squeezes and unknown scary enough. So they said, let's dive as well. Let's put it underwater and also throw in some decompression sickness also, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think about that either. It's all of the problems of scuba diving and caving combined.
Uh-huh.
Plus
into
some
one messed up hobby.
Yeah, I mean, how does one get into cave diving? I don't know of a cave diving club, you know?
Well,
you gotta really want it.
It's true. You do have to want it. I feel like you must start out as just a regular old scuba diver, and then maybe you make your way into a really easy cave, and then you're like, this is kind of cool. And then from there, it just snowballs.
Yeah. You're like, this is kind of cool. And like, this is where the descent begins, you know?
The actual literal descent.
Metaphorically and physically, you know?
But let's jump in, because like I said, we have three stories, and I have quite a bit to tell you about, and I'm sure you'll have plenty to talk to me about.
Sure.
Okay. So this first cave diving story is about the Emerald Sink Cave. Emerald Sink is a stunning, highly iconic cenote-style cavern and cave diving site located in the Leon Sinks geographical area of the Apalachicola National Forest, south of Tallahassee, Florida. It features crystal clear green water and deep vertical drops. It's a very short hike, less than 20 yards from the main parking area. This cave is very deep. It reaches depths of around 162 feet, and that's just how deep it goes, but then you can go horizontal in that depth, and it's a very large cave system as well.
Rock on.
It connects to the Wakula Springs cave system, which is part of one of the most extensive underwater cave networks in the United States.
Really, in Florida?
Yeah.
I would have never thought. I would have thought maybe even in the desert, like by the Grand Canyon or the Rockies or Appalachia.
Nope, just Tallahassee, Florida.
Good old Tallahassee.
The morning of December 15th, 1988, the weather was beautiful. A man named Bill Cronin and two other divers stood at Emerald Sink preparing for a cave dive. And I really only have Bill Cronin's name. For whatever reason, the names of these other two divers that were with him were never reported. I'm not sure why, but that's just how it goes. Bill was an experienced cave diver. He had a basic cave certification from the National Speleological Society cave diving section, and throughout his career, he'd completed several cave dives. A basic cave diving certification, which is often called Intro to Cave or Cave 1, is the first level of technical training that allows you to penetrate beyond the reach of natural sunlight. It bridges the gap between recreational cavern diving and full cave exploration, focusing on high-stress problem-solving and precision skills. For a basic cave diving certification, the maximum depth is generally 100 feet or 30 meters, so you're not supposed to exceed that. Bill's two friends were also basic cave certified and had gone diving together in the past. However, Bill was the most experienced. He had somewhere between 100 and 125 cave dives under his belt already, and they trusted his knowledge and leadership. Their plan for the day was to enter the cave system using the existing guideline laid by divers before them and stay together as a team as they made their way through. They also planned to turn back while they still had plenty of breathing gas, because you do not want to cut it close in that kind of situation. Bill would be diving with an advanced set of diving gear, which were side-mounted twin 80s, two independent scuba tanks mounted low on his hips. It was a setup that constantly required switching between two regulators and monitoring two separate tank pressures. So it was definitely a much more advanced setup than just your basic stuff. And his two companions were using a more standard setup of dual manifold double 80s, where both tanks are connected and share the same regulator system. So the regulator is like the thing that you put in your mouth to breathe through. So Bill had two regulators, and his two companions just had one. All three of them would be diving with multiple lights, proper thermal protection, and standard cave diving safety equipment. So with everything all laid out and double-checked, they were ready to go. This dive would take them far beyond what their training had taught them was safe diving. They were supposed to only be diving through simple passages with simple navigation. And they were supposed to stay above 100 feet, and maximum penetration should have been no more than one-third of a single tank or one-sixth of doubles. And they should have been avoiding decompression dives altogether. But they were planning on going deeper than what was allowed, and using one-third of their doubles instead of one-sixth, and conduct a dive that would definitely require decompression stops on their way out. But Bill supposedly had a habit of pushing his certification limits and encouraging others to do the same. He had supposedly been repeatedly warned by instructors, including his own basic cave instructor, to complete his full training before attempting more advanced dives. But he was ignoring these suggestions and continued diving beyond his certification limits.
Oh, Billy boy.
Yeah.
I can't be doing that.
Yeah, he was a little bigger than his britches, I think.
Bigger than his wetsuit.
That morning they got into the water and began their descent. Emerald Sink's entrance is easy to access and beautiful, through clear turquoise water before reaching the cave passages below. And initially, visibility was good and their conditions were very ideal. Once they made it down through the entrance, they spotted the permanent guideline, which was a bright orange rope strung through the cave. This line would lead them deeper through the passages, winding through the limestone caverns until they came to a line junction, which was an intersection where multiple lines met. So they needed to figure out which way they were going to go from there because they had options. Ultimately, they decided to just go straight, and so they continued past the junction and continued following the main line deeper into the cave, which took them deeper and deeper under the water. until finally they reached a depth of about 150 feet, or 45 meters, which was 50 feet beyond the maximum allowed for their certification, which is quite significant. They had penetrated roughly 800 feet into the cave system, which was their plan, so at that point, Bill Cronin decided it was time for them to turn around. He signaled to the others, and they began their exit, following the guideline back the way they'd come. Everything seemed normal as they retraced their route through the passages until they reached the line junction that they had passed on the way in. The divers followed the line marked with existing exit arrows that had been placed by previous divers, which were extremely important since they hadn't placed their own line markers along the way. Placing line markers is a standard practice that helps divers know exactly where they are and where they came from, since sometimes being in a cave system can be very disorienting.
Imagine that.
Yeah. For one, it's dark. It's also common for one wrong kick to send mud or sediment up into the cave, which takes away divers' visibility, and that can be extremely dangerous. And before any of that, the cave can just look the same as you're going through it. It's all rock, so sometimes it's hard to make out exactly where you've already been, especially when the visibility changes, which can happen in a second. So they passed the intersection and continued following the arrowed line, believing they were heading toward the exit, until Bill shone his light at the other two and signaled they were going the wrong way and needed to turn back. There is zero communicating with words when you're diving, so the only thing you can do is use specific hand gestures. So it wasn't like the three of them could have a conversation at this point. They could basically just give each other like a thumbs up or an okay signal or, you know, things like that. And his friends were surprised and confused. Based on the arrowed line, this should have been the way to the exit. But Bill, who was the more experienced diver, was now telling them that it was wrong. They were in a really tough position because Bill had done way more cave dives than the two of them and was supposed to be their leader. But they both felt like they were already going the right way out, and making a wrong call in this situation could be fatal. But since he was their leader, they followed Bill back into the darkness of the cave where he had been signaling was the right way. And once they returned to the line junction, for now the third time, Bill pointed down to a deeper tunnel, which was not the way out. It actually led to a different cave system called Clear Cut Sink, about 5,000 feet or 1,524 meters away, which was a much deeper and complex cave system far beyond their training level. But this was just like at the line junction. There was a different direction, and Bill thought that like that was the way they had come in.
Oh no.
Yeah. The other two were genuinely scared at this point because they both really felt like that wasn't the way out, and when they checked their air supply, they saw that they were already running dangerously low because they'd been underwater for a really long time. They didn't have the air reserves to make another wrong call. They both felt certain that the arrowed line was the correct exit route, but they couldn't talk about it. They could really only signal, so they tried to communicate with Bill as best they could, but he really thought he was right. So ultimately, since he was the leader and fully believed he was doing the right thing, he pointed deeper into the cave, turned, and began swimming in that direction, deeper into the darkness.
How do they live? I just don't understand. If they follow him, they're dead, right? They don't have air.
They don't have enough air to make the wrong decision.
What are they at right now?
I mean, I don't know their exact levels, but they knew that if they made another wrong turn, it could mean death for all three of them.
Right.
They were in a really tough spot because Bill was their leader. And also, they had made this plan of not splitting up because that's just a safety thing too. So their leader has already swam in a different direction. He's done 125 dives and he knows a lot more than them about cave diving, it seems.
Yeah, well, I mean, the arrows don't lie.
Right, that's what they're thinking, because they also had a basic cave diving certification, so they knew just about as much as him as far as training went.
Right.
But as far as experience went, he had more.
Right.
So it was a very stressful moment for everyone, and they all knew that their air was running low.
Yeah, I mean, do they yoink him back?
No, they can't. He already swam away. He turned around and swam.
get to Yoinkin. You know, that's what I say.
Get to Yoinkin. At this point, survival instinct won over loyalty to Bill. And it was a very terrible decision for them, but they couldn't afford to make a wrong call, like I said. So instead of following Bill down into the darkness, they chose to turn back toward the line with the exit arrows and follow that once again.
Oh my God.
And Bill chose to go deeper into the passage, which he believed was correct. So now Bill's alone, and the other two are swimming with the exit arrows.
Whoa.
And soon the other two divers made it back to the entrance at Emerald Sink, which was good for them, but they also knew what that meant for Bill. But they were already in critical condition. Their air supplies were nearly exhausted, and they hadn't had enough air left to complete their required decompression stops on the ascent, which is incredibly dangerous. Decompression stops are pauses that a scuba diver has to make while ascending to allow their body to safely eliminate excess nitrogen that's absorbed under pressure. They're essential to prevent formation of gas bubbles in the blood and tissues, which causes decompression sickness, commonly known as the bends. So they had to make these stops along the way, at least they were supposed to, in order to not get the bends, which can be fatal, but they didn't have time to because they didn't have air.
Take your chances, because yeah. The no air is 100%.
Right. I think that's probably one of the scariest parts of diving to me, is if something goes wrong, you can't immediately get out of there. You have to take like 2 to 3 minute stops at certain depths to have a safe exit. But they didn't have that luxury because the confusion had taken too much time. They had been forced to make an emergency ascent and had to risk the bends to avoid drowning from lack of air. Fortunately, they had left oxygen bottles at the surface as a precaution, and they immediately began breathing supplemental oxygen to help off-gas the excess nitrogen in their blood from the deep dive. And even though they had made the emergency ascent, thankfully, neither of them had been experiencing any symptoms of the bends. So they were just lucky, I guess. Although they were fine, they knew Bill was likely not. And at the surface, they waited and watched for bubbles or any sign of him, but he never showed. So they quickly called for help. Bill was still somewhere deep within the cave system alone and following what he believed was the correct line. A rescue team was immediately assembled of experienced cave divers who specifically knew the Emerald Sink cave system very well, and they went in checking all the different passages for Bill. And finally, they found his body at 300 feet from the entrance of Emerald Sink at a depth of 117 feet. His position in the cave was particularly tragic because he was in a small air pocket in the ceiling of the cave. And the guideline was at a depth of 145 feet. So it was speculated that he had become separated from the guideline and was possibly either trying to find it again or was attempting to breathe at this small air pocket at the top of the cave, but ultimately ran out and died.
Oh, so tragic. Just one wrong call.
Yeah. The accident analysis that was conducted pointed to multiple different contributing factors to his death. His depth gauge read 160 feet, or 48.7 meters, which means he had unknowingly descended another 10 feet after separating from his team. And experts then determined that he swam another 200 feet deeper into the cave system toward Clearcut Sink. But Clearcut Sink, like I said earlier, was 5,000 feet away. So there was no chance in hell that the amount of air that he had would allow him to even make it to Clearcut Sink. And by the time he made it to 200 feet deeper into this cave system, it was already too late. He only had enough air in his tank for a few breaths at best at that depth. And both of his regulators were found significantly out of adjustment, and they were both clogged. So they would have been working poorly at that depth, forcing him to exert extra effort just to breathe. So even while he did still have air in his tanks, he even had to use extra effort just to breathe because his regulators were like messed up.
Oh my God, this is one of the worst ends that you can meet.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So terrifying. And he must have known in that moment that he made the wrong call and that there was nothing he could do, really.
Yeah, and then you fully realize it before.
Right, and Jesus. So that's probably why he let go of the guideline that was running through the cave, which is like, it's your lifeline. Quite literally. So him letting go of it and swimming up was like truly just like a last ditch effort at finding any sort of savior. And he did find an air pocket, but sadly he did still pass away. But back to his regulators that were like out of whack, this would have accelerated nitrogen narcosis, which is a state of cognitive impairment caused by breathing nitrogen under pressure. It's often called depth intoxication or the martini effect. It's a temporary alteration in consciousness experienced by scuba divers. It occurs when breathing compressed nitrogen at deep depths, where increased pressure causes a gas to act as a mild anesthetic, creating sensations similar to alcohol intoxication.
Wild. So like it's all, you're consuming extra nitrogen under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be both of those,
I guess. Yeah. So symptoms typically start around 100 feet or 30 meters, and they worsen as a diver descends deeper. And struggling to breathe quickly intensifies it. So some of the symptoms are impaired judgment, poor concentration, short-term memory loss, overconfidence, and euphoria. In some severe cases, it can lead to hallucinations, confusion, and anxiety. It also causes delayed reaction times, poor coordination, and sometimes involuntary muscle twitches or tingling in the face and extremities.
Wow. Who knew?
Yeah. So that's why it's called, I guess, the martini effect, or, you know, whatever I said earlier.
Well, if he got to 160 meters and it starts at 30, I mean, how fucked up was he?
No, he was at 160 feet.
What was the max that they went down? Because you were saying they were trying to go 150 meters down.
No, I'm sorry. I keep jumping back and forth between feet and meters. So he ended up, like his maximum depth ended up being around 160 feet, which was around 47 something meters.
Oh.
Which was still way deeper than he should have been. Like he should have only ever gone down to 100 feet, but he ended up at 160.
Okay. I don't know. So but he was past this martini depth for a long time.
Yeah, well past it.
So they all the symptoms line up.
Yeah, and it explained his irrational decision at the line junction. He was supposedly already heavily impaired by narcosis when he made the decision to turn away from the other two divers and go deeper into the cave. So he was essentially drunk on nitrogen, and he had just had impaired judgment and like all of those symptoms that I just listed. And so he turned away. Also, the stress of the moment also likely caused him to breathe heavily, which would have eaten up his air supply faster than it should have, and it also increased his level of nitrogen narcosis. So it was just a terrible combination of things. This condition is completely reversible without long-term effects, and symptoms disappear almost instantly upon ascending to shallower water, but unfortunately he wasn't able to get to shallower water. Because that's the thing about caves, is you can't just swim up. You're in a cave. And his lights were found to have low batteries, which confirmed poor overall equipment maintenance, and only his main light was functioning. So it seems like all of his equipment was kind of poorly maintained, and he was making poor decisions to begin with, and also the nitrogen narcosis affected his judgment when he was deeper in the cave. So this accident sparked conversation within the cave diving community around certification limits and training standards. And he's kind of used as a cautionary tale. Like, if you don't listen to your certification limits and you're overconfident and, you know, whatever, you can truly die. Like, this is a very unforgiving sport. There are very strict safety measures in place to make it safe.
Well, like, as safe as it can be.
Yeah, right? As safe as it can be. But at the same time, if you don't follow something very closely, then it can actually kill you very easily.
Yeah, I'm sure in any dangerous sport, like hubris is the worst.
Yeah.
Or maybe one of the most dangerous attitudes you can have.
Totally. But Emerald Sink is still a popular dive site to this day, and the passages are still there. The cave system is now better mapped and better understood and subject to stricter access protocols. But that's what happened in Emerald Sink in 1988.
That's sad, but I guess I'm glad for the two beginner guys that they, you know, had the conviction to just follow their gut.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of had to. Like, it was survival instinct.
Right.
It seems like they weren't experiencing nitrogen narcosis, so they had clear heads. Maybe if he hadn't been experiencing nitrogen narcosis, he would have actually realized that the exit arrows were the correct way, because the exit arrows are specifically placed to notify the divers which way to go. So he must have been pretty impaired to go a different direction.
Right. Yeah. It's just sad.
It is. And so scary.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, I guess the morbid positive side to this is that his example has saved a lot of people, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
From making the same mistake. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure nobody wants to sacrifice themselves for that.
Yeah, be the example.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely was not his intention.
Yep.
But that's how it goes. Very unforgiving sport, it seems. That's all I really have to say about that for story number one. Do you want to move on to the second one?
Let's do it.
Okay. This is the Veryovkina Cave incident, which is the deepest cave on Earth.
Word?
Yeah.
How deep? How deep is your cave?
I'm going to get into that. But actually, this one isn't cave diving. This is more caving, but there's a lot of water involved.
Excuse me?
I'm going to get into it. Okay. It is located in the Caucasus Mountains, which is also home to Europe's highest peak, Mount Elbrus, at 18,500 feet or 5,639 meters. On the western side of the region is a sub-range of the mountains known as the Gagra Range, and there is a decent-sized mountain in this area as well, but it's more famous for its caves.
Right.
It is primarily limestone mountain range carved out by rivers over its geological history. The prehistoric rivers created a bunch of deep canyons.
Love a good limestone range.
Sure.
You know?
It's home to four of the deepest caves anywhere on Earth. And the deepest is Veryovkina Cave at over 7,000 feet or 2,314 meters.
Holy shit. Is that like as deep as the trench? The Marinus Trench?
You know, I actually don't know the depth of that, but if you want to Google it, go ahead. But to visualize what that depth actually means, it would be like stacking 23 Statue of Liberties on top of each other or six Eiffel Towers.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
All right. Hold on. The Mariana Trench reaches a maximum known depth of approximately 11,000 meters.
Oh, it's way deeper than this cave.
At its lowest point. Okay. Well, how deep is it again?
2,314 meters.
Okay, but it's like a fifth.
Yeah, it's deep. Insanely deep.
That's crazy. But I mean, it's in the continent of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
yeah,
a 2,000 meter deep hole in the earth.
Yes, down a mountain too. Or inside a mountain, I guess.
Inside a mountain.
Yeah.
Whoa. Wait, so is it measured from ground level or is it measured from peak of mountain?
No, from the entrance of the cave, like down into the cave.
Bro.
So to even get to this cave, you first have to climb a mountain. The entrance to Veryovkina Cave is located at an altitude of 7,500 feet.
Okay, so this is the trick. You have to go up to get into the cave.
Correct.
So then you just come back down to ground level just in a cave.
Kind of, I suppose, but you're still going deep into a cave and you can't get out until you re-exit the cave the way you came in.
That's so crazy. Dude, this mountain range is putting up numbers.
Yeah, you could say that. Once you're up there, you're surrounded by rocky cliffs of the mountain ranges, and in the middle of the cliffs is a small 3-meter opening in the ground. And that is the entrance to this cave.
It's the portal.
Yeah, it's an obvious entrance to a cave, but it is quite unexpected how deep it actually goes. When the entrance to the cave was discovered in 1968 by a group of cavers, they only descended down to a depth of 377 feet before hitting a dead end and returning to the surface. And then, in 1983, the cave was explored by a separate team, the Perovo-Spelio Caving Team, which was an official group of world-class cavers from Moscow that has been exploring Veryovkina for a long time. Or they would, at least.
Sorry, what country is this hole in?
It's in Georgia.
Oh, Atlanta.
Atlanta.
We're going cave diving in Georgia, Atlanta.
Not the same Georgia.
By Russia.
Yeah, not the same Georgia. So the Perovo Caving Team in 1983 entered the cave for the first time, and instead of going to the right at a fork, they actually went left, and they discovered that this cave was much deeper than the first team that went in.
They ooped to the side.
Sure. Yeah, you could say that. Over the next 3 years, this team conducted multiple expeditions and pushed the depth to around 1,400 feet or 427 meters before hitting other obstacles that made them have to head back. There was still a lot more cave to discover, but due to the collapse of the Soviet Union, exploration was forced to stop and didn't resume until 2000. And in 2015, the Perovo team discovered a new vertical shaft on the right side of the cave. Over the next 3 years, they continued pushing deeper and deeper until finally they found an ancient underground lake at the very bottom of the cave in March of 2018.
They found a lake?
Yes.
In the mountain.
Mm-hmm. They also mapped over 10 miles or 17 kilometers of tunnels and passages.
I mean, dude, these people don't stop, man. No. What's going on? This 10 is, miles of cave?
Yeah, this, I mean, this is kind of their whole gig. So
plus lake.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, is this is just like what people did before Minecraft, right? Like
Minecraft IRL. Yeah.
They had no Minecraft to explore the caves.
Yeah, back in my day, we had to just explore the caves.
We had to go to real caves, okay? Yeah,
right. 6 months later, in September, the Perovo team returned once again to continue exploring the cave system because this is their favorite thing to do.
Is this just what they do on the weekend?
This is, I mean, I don't think it's just the weekend. I think this is their whole gig. It's like their job, I think.
How do they make money?
I don't know.
Does the government pay them to like go check out the cave?
Go look into cave.
Go look into cave. Tell us where cave go and we'll pay you.
Probably.
I don't know.
It sounds right to me.
Is that even halfway decent of an accent?
A little bit. So this time they were joined by British National Geographic cave photographers, Robbie Schoen and his photo assistant, Jeff Wade. Because now they're not just exploring, they've already hit the bottom. So they're like, let's document this shit.
Yeah, I get the BBC in here.
Yeah. The team was led by Pavel Demidov. And in addition to him, there was about 5 or 6 other cavers with them. However, I'm going to spare you all my butchered pronunciation of all of these Russian names. It was a bunch of Russian cave divers. That's who it was. This expedition would be returning to the bottom of the cave system to collect samples of some of the potentially undiscovered species and explore some of the horizontal passages at the bottom of the cave, all while having the photographers document their findings along the way.
Crazy. Wait, so are there fish in the lake?
That's a good question. I don't think so.
Are there living beings?
I don't think so. I think when they talk about other species, they're talking about, like, I don't know, bacteria or something.
Plankton.
Yeah, probably something like that.
Sweet.
Maybe I sound like an idiot, but that's what I assume.
Not fish.
It's not fish. And it's not like weird cave animals. In an ordinary cave, you can descend and ascend in one day. However, this cave was so deep, it would take 4 whole days just to reach the bottom. Even in a cave that takes only one day, you'd still be bringing in a ton of equipment because you need so much climbing gear and food for everyone on your team. But for this cave, they had to set up something similar to an expedition you'd expect to see when climbing a large mountain. So they had several camps that were set up along the path down for the climbers to rest and restock their supplies along the way. Because the amount of gear they would need to go all the way down was way too much to transport at a single time. It required thousands of feet of rope and a ton of other equipment and food.
Bro, they're like setting up a supply chain?
They had to. Yeah, and these are permanent camps that stay in the cave.
Like inside underwater in
not
the
under,
cave?
Not underwater. This cave is not underwater. It's just a cave.
Oh, okay.
When all was said and done, they had 6 camps set up all the way down to the bottom. The climbers put on special clothing, harnesses, and helmets fit with headlamps, and descended down the narrow shaft into the darkness and moved through a series of tight tunnels and passages to reach the first camp at 2,000 feet. This camp is a permanent installation in the cave where gear and equipment is stored year-round for emergencies. And then over the course of the next 4 days, the Perovo team made their way down to Camp 6 at the bottom at 6,900 feet. On their way down, the temperature was only a few degrees above freezing. The cavers had descended thousands of feet of ropes, crawled through water and mud-choked siphons, and squeezed themselves and their heavy gear through insane cracks. And at one point, they descended down a 100-foot shaft of nothing but air. So they had to just kind of dangle. The thousands of feet of rope that they used to descend were their only means of transportation in and out. And finally, they made it to the flat, sandy ground at Camp 6 that was set up in a large horizontal tunnel. And this would be their home for the remainder of the expedition. The team had already spent 3 days there, launching explorations into new corridors, collecting invertebrate specimens, and taking photographs.
Oh, that's probably how they make bank, is they sell shit to universities. They're like, hey, found this mollusk, dude. Does your archaeology department want this?
That sounds right to me. Over the next 3 days, the team went deeper into this horizontal cave until finally they brought Robbie and Jeff to the lake at the very, very bottom. And when they got there, they were stunned to find a beautiful turquoise body of water surrounded by jet black limestone. The lake was 50 feet long, 25 feet wide, and 28 feet deep.
So this is more like a pond?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's not massive, but there's a body of water at the bottom of this cave. It's not a great lake, but it is a lake.
No.
Okay.
That's a pond.
Sure, whatever you say. By day 7, everything was still going to plan, and that day, 2 members of the team had to leave early to catch a flight home. And when they got up to Camp 3, at 1,300 meters below the surface, they saw there was a ton of water pouring into the cave.
Oh, shit.
A massive storm on the surface had caused a flood pulse that was sending thousands of liters of water rushing into the cave.
Not good.
That in itself wasn't immediately alarming, because whenever it rains, that causes water to flow into the cave. Also, this cave is so large and deep that the likelihood of it filling up was pretty low. But these 2 members of the team still wanted to let the explorers below know what was going on. Because, you know, they're at the very bottom, so...
Yeah, what do? You just kind of yell down and it echoes.
Right. So inside the caves, you can't really communicate wirelessly because of the thick layers of rock. So instead, they needed to run a physical line through the entire length of the cave to communicate. So they did have a line, but they had to physically lay it themselves.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. The 2 team members immediately tapped into the cable to warn the others about the flood that was headed their way. And down at Camp 6, they weren't very worried when they got this call. Cavers deal with flood pulses all the time, because when it rains, that water kind of has to go somewhere. And a flood pulse can last a few minutes or even a few hours, but it eventually subsides. But not nearly as experienced as the Perovo team, Robbie Schoen was pretty concerned with the speed and volume that the water was coming down. But the spot they were in was completely dry, so he tried to stay calm like the rest of them. Camp 6 had been set up off the main vertical shaft in an area that was away from the flow of water, so even though the main vertical shaft was spewing an unfathomable volume of water, their camp seemed well protected and was still dry, so they figured they were in the safest spot possible. They decided that they would monitor the water levels and then plan accordingly. So there's not really much they can do at this point. They're like, let's just see if it fills up, I guess.
I don't know. At that point, is it too late? Like, what would you do if it starts to fill up?
Well, so they didn't expect it to fill up, because for the water to reach them, it would have to fill up 300 feet of passages below them before it would reach them. So...
Oh, so as it's passing them, it's going...
Down.
Down. Okay, yeah. So there's somewhere to go.
Totally. And the water hadn't reached them after this warning call until 30 minutes later. So it took 30 whole minutes for the water that was coming down this cave to even reach where they were.
Damn. And it's still going?
Yep.
So there's like a continuous flow of water for 30 minutes?
Massive flow of water. Yeah.
Really from where, big man? And
deep. I mean, above.
Mother Mountain.
Yeah. Mother Earth, I guess.
Wow.
They were eating breakfast, and then, as I said, 30 minutes after the phone call, they heard this massive rumble that was like a freight train hurtling toward the tunnel, and then the entire cave began to shake as if it were like an earthquake, and then it got louder and louder until finally there was this like massive spew of water that was just coming down.
Jesus, I mean, how terrifying.
Yeah, that's why Robbie Schoen was so scared, and he said it was a sound that he would never forget.
Yeah, I mean, this is worse than like a Jurassic Park dinosaur.
Yeah, right.
That you hear.
Yeah. By the time the water had just about reached the camp, it was so loud it was almost deafening. The entire cave shook like a constant earthquake was happening. And hearing the thunder of the loud flood pulse coming, Sean and the other cavers rushed out of the tent. About 2 hours into the flooding, one of them happened to notice a gurgling sound coming out of a small hole in the ground adjacent to their tent. He couldn't see any water, but given that the flood pulse had already been raging for over 2 hours with no signs of stopping, it presented enough of a concern that he told the team leader, Pavel Demidov, about the noise. And he agreed with his teammate's concern and enlisted the assistance of several others to join him in checking on a nearby siphon. They were trying to gauge how high the water had actually risen. And no more than 5 minutes later, the water was rising up so quickly that it was sloshing off of the walls, almost out of the hole. So it was kind of like the hole that connected them to the deeper parts of the cave. And they were like, if this fills up, then we can panic. But it like hadn't been. And then 5 minutes later, they see that this hole is now kind of like gurgling with water. And it's like sloshing off the walls of the cave.
So it's time to panic.
Yes. Robbie said when this caver turned and looked at him, his face was white, and he said, quote, I just thought, oh my goodness, we have to leave right now. We cannot wait. If we just hang around, we're all going to die. The freight train of floodwater continued to tear through this dark cave, and the roar, like I said, was almost deafening. No one had expected to be leaving camp that day, but suddenly all hell had broken loose as everyone was scrambling to pack up their essential gear. They couldn't even bring all of their gear. At this point, they only had minutes to get out of there. So they had to grab whatever they needed and then get the hell out. Robbie and the others pulled on their latex suit over their fleece gear and then slipped on their abrasion-resistant nylon shells, harnesses, helmets, and rope ascending gear. And both photographers made the calculated decision to leave all of their cameras and personal gear behind, which was tens of thousands of dollars in equipment, but when you're looking at life or death, it doesn't really matter. There was over a mile of vertical ropes to climb above them, and taking a heavy pack might slow them down and kill them, and possibly everybody else. Robbie Schoen did, however, take his camera's flashcards, as they contained the only photographs ever captured of the cave system. So he's like, I won't take the camera, but I'll take the little memory card. And he placed them in a Ziploc bag and slipped it inside his latex suit.
Yep, and Nat Geo thanked him for his service.
Yeah, seriously. And all of them are screaming at each other to, like, get moving, because they're all panicking at this point. And they decide that these two photographers are going to go first, because they're the least experienced. So the two of them head out first with all the other more experienced cavers behind them. But they couldn't really see them because they were panicking and like moving so quickly. And also it's dark, so they kind of just had to climb and hope. Robbie headed toward the ropes that led up and out, and he reached a very precarious spot which had been above an airy shaft 8 meters wide and 20 meters deep, but now this shaft was completely filled with water. So they're having to do all the extremely dangerous and technically difficult parts of this cave, but now they're fighting through like a constant stream of water because the main shaft is where this water was coming down through. And so some of the times they're having to literally fight their way through this massive gush of water and can barely breathe. So they just had to like kind of keep their heads down and give themselves just enough air in this, in like the pocket between like their chest and their mouths to fight their way up through this stream of water that's coming down. And like a lot of the portions of this cave are tight squeezes and like little holes and things you have to shimmy through. And it's like a constant stream of water.
Oh my God. They're just trying to outrun the cave.
Yeah, that's actually filling with water. And they did not expect that because this cave is so massive, but so was this stream of water. Robbie Schoen said the weight of the water was tremendous and it pummeled him as he climbed. He said, quote, it felt like my head was being squashed into my shoulders. But he tucked his chin and breathed from a pocket of air formed by the space created beneath his helmet brim. He moved as fast as he could. He'd actually worked years prior as a high-rise window washer, and because of that, he knew some other rope-ascending techniques. And at the time, that was what paid his bills, and photography was just kind of a hobby. But now his window washing had allowed him to hone skills that were saving his life.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, isn't that funny? He said, quote, "All I could see was the white rope in front of me, and I just kept moving the ascender up a little bit at a time. I was saying to myself, just keep going, just keep doing this." And he reached a point where he could step to the side out of the gushing water, and he looked up to see where the rope was running, and it led into a body-sized chimney of rock, which the flood was rushing through. So there's this space that is only big enough for your body, and it is full of water that's coming through it. He said, quote, "I just thought, you're joking. I physically can't get through that. Where am I going to go? There's no airspace. There's nothing. But I also knew I hadn't gone far enough yet. I hadn't climbed high enough to be safe. And I was the lead guy. I couldn't just stop here because Jeff and everyone else was coming up behind me. I needed to keep going." So he climbed into this chimney-like section, forcing his way up through the narrow shaft, and the water was pummeling him. He could only push his ascender up a few inches at a time, and he took sips of air as he struggled to climb through the flow. He said, quote, "As I finally got past that section, I remember thinking, oh my God, I really hope Jeff can do that, because he's got to do that." He said he was nearly panicking. All he could think to do was keep climbing as fast and as high as possible. And having passed through the narrow space, he found himself ascending in a relatively dry section where the flood had taken a different path. And then he heard Jeff yelling below him, "Robbie, Robbie, slow down. We're safe now. Just slow down." Jeff's face was white and he had massive eyes. And he just said, "Bloody hell, we're alive." Which was a happy moment until they realized they had no idea if the rest of their team was still alive, because they're all much more experienced cavers, but they were significantly deeper than them, and they didn't know how quickly this water was actually rising. So there was possibility that these cavers, although experienced, literally just drowned in the flood. Robbie and Jeff had climbed up to a camp at 1900 meters, where there was a tent stocked with some food and medical supplies, but the flood continued to shake the floor beneath them like an earthquake. And they looked down into the abyss and saw one single headlamp appear coming up the ropes. It was one of the other members of their team. And Jeff asked him, "Have you seen the others?" But he shook his head, "No." And the three sat there in silence, worried that the worst had happened. But 15 minutes later, more headlamps appeared, one by one. All five of the remaining Russian cave divers came up the ropes. Robbie Schoen said he couldn't believe it. He said, quote, "These guys are so strong and so capable. Kostya had even carried up a pack with sleeping bags, a stove, and a brew kit, whereas I had almost selfishly only thought about my photos. Kostya had brought four sleeping bags." So this photographer's like, damn it. He's making me look bad. The others had escaped in the nick of time. By the time Robbie Schoen had escaped, the area that they were in was almost completely submerged. The Russians had to swim to access the vertical ropes going through the waterfall.
Are you kidding me? So they're at the level, and if it just reaches the ceiling, they're screwed.
Yes, they had to climb faster than the water was rising, but at that point, they're basically swimming to get to the ropes.
Wow. Yeah. Talk about being behind the eight ball.
Yeah. And the leader had gotten caught in a circular, swirling current of water that sent him spinning as if he were being flushed down a giant toilet bowl. And he fought the current and swam hard to reach the line. So he almost got flushed into this cave, but he managed to swim harder and faster than it was flushing him.
Dude, this is some Indiana Jones type shit.
Yeah. Schoen said, quote, "In hindsight, I'm so glad it was almost like the weakest one went first and the strongest one came last. This was at my limit of what I could possibly deal with." Yeah, he had it by far the easiest, and even his experience was insanely difficult and scary, and he almost died. So imagine what the last guy had.
Yeah. Well, now, desperation breeds ingenuity.
Yeah. Now that the team had reunited in a safer location, they spent the next 16 hours at that camp. And not long at all after arriving there, they made themselves comfortable in the tent, fired up some coffee, and began laughing about how they all almost died.
Yeah, I mean, how do you go to sleep after that?
Right, but meanwhile, the flood was still raging. Like, the flood is still happening, but they're high enough into the cave that they're like, it's fine.
No, I want to get out of there.
Yeah.
Like, I would just full ascend.
Right? Robbie Schoen was still very freaked out, and he kept all of his caving gear on and absolutely could not sleep, and he kept peering over the side into the abyss to see if the water was rising, because they're just kind of on a ledge. He was concerned about a pseudo-siphon 70 meters above them. It was a long horizontal tunnel that was normally half filled with water, and under typical circumstances, the only way to get through it was crawl. But if this portion of the cave flooded, that area would have been completely choked with water. So as long as the flood continued, they were basically trapped. So it's like they couldn't really leave at that point if they wanted to, because an area that was typically half filled with water would have been completely filled with water. So they had to wait for the flood to stop to even go any further.
Oh, so this is actually as far as they can ascend.
At this point, yes, but they also feel safe enough, at least the experienced ones do, that they are confident that the flood is going to stop before it reaches them.
Here's a question. Does it matter?
I guess kind of not really. Like, maybe they could have pushed through this other portion of the cave that would have been filled with water, but I don't think so. Schoen said, quote, if the water had risen high enough to reach us, it would have been game over. But after a few hours of pacing, he finally relaxed somewhat and he joined the others in the tent and stripped down to his fleece and warmed himself. The leader told him that they would wait until morning before they freaked out because it was more than likely that the flood would stop by then. And he was right. At some point, it started to die down, but the flood pulse had ultimately lasted nearly 20 hours straight.
Oh my God. Was it like some freak storm or?
It was. Yeah, it was the result of a week of rain, including a single storm cell that had unleashed rain the size of fingernails for an entire day, is how it was described.
Whoa.
Apparently, that was how a local taxi driver later described the rain.
That's like a biblical amount of rain.
Yeah. The ground was completely saturated, and somewhere in the earth, something had cracked that had unleashed just an ungodly volume of water. So it was like a ton of rain, and then something broke, and it sent all of it down.
Well, all you need is one crack.
I guess. The Russians had been operating under the presumption that Veryovkina was only flooded in the winter, which they now learned was not true. It flooded all the time if there was enough water.
Thanks to the new crack.
Right. This experience was ultimately educational for the cavers, and they made plans to improve surface monitoring, including using special radios to improve communications. They also installed a new camp in the lowest chamber that would provide another escape spot in the event of another flood. Despite the flood pulse cutting their trip short by a day, the expedition was successful. New passages were mapped and explored, and several cave invertebrates were taken for analysis, and a number of climbs were completed. In fact, this team felt like they had only scratched the surface of what secrets the world's deepest cave might hold. Robbie Schoen said, quote, this is the pinnacle of human endeavor in the caving world.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, like, to think about, like, what modern inventions have allowed people to just do now. You can just cave. That's your job. It's all you do.
Right.
That's what we're doing with it. We're exploring caves. It's pretty cool.
It is cool. And even though this exploration mission had gone so crazy, Robbie Schoen planned to return to the cave with them to get more pictures because he also has a love for the game.
He loves the game. Somebody almost got flushed into the earth.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, yeah, going back.
Let's Cheerio. Do it again. Right. So yeah, that was how that went. Thankfully, none of them died, although they all came pretty close to it, except for the two that had left like early to catch a flight or something. They were the ones that sent down the warning in the first place.
That's me.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out.
Well, actually, me, I'm probably just like the taxi driver that was like, that rain was crazy.
It was a fingernail rain.
Yeah.
For a day.
Yeah, you'll never catch me in a cave.
I'll go in a cave.
Okay.
I actually went ziplining in a cave.
Very cool.
It was pretty sweet. I don't think you would have liked it, though.
I don't think so either.
But anyway, I digress.
Well, that brings us to our third and final story for the episode. This is one that actually just happened a few days ago.
What?
Yeah, this is a story that has been breaking over the past week. And there was like a rescue mission that was happening over this past week. So this happened on May 14th. The day we're recording is like May 27th. So,
okay.
Yeah, this is like truly days ago.
Wow.
The Maldives cave diving incident happened on Thursday, May 14th, when a group of five Italian divers vanished during a deep water dive inside a cave 164 feet underwater in Vavu Atoll, in what officials called the worst diving accident in the island nation's history. The victims were identified as Monica Montefalcone, an ecology professor, her daughter, Georgia Somacall, marine biologist Federico Gualteri, researcher Muriel Audenino, and diving instructor Gianluca Benedetti. Monica Montefalcone was a 51-year-old professor of ecology and marine ecologist at the University of Genoa. She was a regular diver in Maldivian waters, and she was the most recognizable scientific figure in the group. Her daughter, Georgia Somacall, was also part of the group, but according to the University of Genoa, she was not a part of the official scientific mission. She was a biomedical engineering student at the same university. Muriel Audenino was a research fellow connected to the university's environmental and life sciences department, and she was in the Maldives as a mission to monitor the marine environment and tropical biodiversity. Federico Gualteri was a recent marine biology and ecology graduate, but the university said he was also not a part of the official scientific mission. Gianluca Benedetti was the diving instructor who had lived in the Maldives for 7 years. So this was a mix of scientists, students, alumni, and a local experienced instructor. So they all understood the sea and that diving was very risky. And there was one survivor in the diving tragedy in the Maldives. This was a female university student who was a part of the research group who narrowly avoided death by deciding at the very last second to stay behind on their mothership while her companions went into the deep underwater cave. So she just didn't go on the dive at all. And she's the only one who lived because of that decision. So on Thursday, May 14th, the group entered the water. It was said they had a permit, however, that permit was not a simple tourist diving permit. The group had been granted permission for a research expedition to research soft corals and deep water marine life. However, Maldivian officials say they were not informed that the group would explore a deep underwater cave, and they did not know this team's exact location. If they had known what this group of people was planning to do, they would have given backup and more equipment. It was also an issue that two of the divers were not even part of the submitted researcher list. So it was later said that this dive was not even part of the planned scientific research. It was more of just a personal endeavor. So things were a bit iffy to begin with, but making it worse was the fact that conditions that day were less than ideal. A yellow weather warning had reportedly been issued, indicating rough conditions and strong winds. And the cave site would have had strong currents, which would result in poor visibility. And this was a deep cave. The group made it all the way down to the cave entrance at 50 meters. And from that point on, they were leaving the open water and going inside the cave, which was like a whole other world. Locals call this cave the Shark Cave. And 50 meters was already far below the normal recreational diving limit in the Maldives, which is 30 meters. At that depth, a dive is already dangerous before you even go into a cave. Divers breathe through their gas faster at that depth, and if something goes wrong, you can't simply swim to the surface. You need to go through stages of decompression during the ascent, as I talked about earlier. The cave made the situation much more dangerous, because now the group didn't just have to come up, they first had to come out of the cave to ascend. The cave system was described as three chambers connected by narrow passages. But this type of cave can be deceptive, because although the chambers might feel spacious and controlled, the passages are the more important parts, because once a diver goes through it, it then becomes their passage back out, and after going through it once, visibility may have changed. It can feel completely different, and your visibility can go from completely clear to zero in one kick of a fin. The entrance opens into the first chamber. From that chamber, they could access a narrow tunnel that led them into the second large chamber. And it's there that the real danger seemed to come in, because the second chamber had no natural light whatsoever and a sandy bottom, which meant if the sand was disturbed, visibility could very quickly drop to zero. And from that second chamber, there was a third tunnel that branched upwards to the third and final chamber. And when rescuers later followed that tunnel, they found four of the divers' bodies in that third chamber. When the divers didn't return at their scheduled time, the people on the boat didn't immediately panic. There were plenty of reasons why they wouldn't have turned up yet, but they kept a close eye at the water looking for any sign of them. Bubbles on the surface, a marker buoy, movement, anything at all, but the water stayed empty. And the longer that went on, the more serious the situation got, until finally they called for help and a search team was assembled. If the divers had drifted away in the open water, the rescue area would be much bigger. Because like I said earlier, the current was really strong at this point. So they're not just thinking, okay, they're definitely in this cave. There was a possibility that they just got swept out to sea, which also would have been a problem. But if the divers entered the cave below, the search was going to be very deep and complicated. So the searchers moved toward the entrance of the cave, and it was there they found the body of Gianluca Benedetti, who was the diving instructor, but they were still missing the other four divers. Among the rescue team was Mohamed Mahoudi, a military diver with the Maldives National Defense Force, and he was extremely experienced. However, during this dive, Mohamed died due to decompression sickness, which affects the joints, the lungs, spinal cord, or the brain, and in severe cases, it can be fatal. And sadly for him, in this case, it was. And after Mohammed's death, the rescue mission had to temporarily stop, not because they weren't concerned about the other four divers, but because at this point, the dive had claimed yet another life, and it had become extremely apparent how dangerous this dive actually was, because he was so experienced. He was a military diver, and it claimed his life. So the question at that point wasn't just where are the missing divers, but how could anyone enter this cave system safely to get them out? So the Maldivian government called in three Finnish cave diving specialists who were sent out to help plan a safer recovery strategy. And so these three Finnish divers went down. And inside the cave, they found that the visibility was clearly reduced, where the group was believed to have become disoriented, eventually running out of air, according to one of the Finnish divers. They believed that one of them just made one small kick the wrong way, and that sent sediment up into their view, and that clouded everyone's view. And by May 20th, they finally found the four remaining bodies. They were in the third and largest chamber of the cave. Benedetti, who was the diving instructor, was believed to have tried to find his way out of the cave before he ran out of air and died near the entrance. And one of the strongest theories was that the current could have pushed the divers deeper inside the cave, which is why they couldn't come out. Because in an underwater cavern, a strong current can feel much stronger than it does in open water. A diver trying to swim against it would use their gas way quicker than normal, which they're already doing at a major depth, so the combination of the two would eat through their breathing gas really, really quickly. But after having the diving experts go down there, they came up with an even more likely possibility. A current may have been a part of the danger, however, the most dangerous aspect of this dive appeared to be because of an optical illusion inside the cave. When entering the second chamber, which was devoid of light and had the sandy bottom, the divers may have disturbed the silt on the bottom, which made visibility zero, and they became disoriented and actually went through the wrong side passage, which led them into the third chamber instead of back out of the cave. So the way the entrance to the third cavern worked was it was just kind of right above the tunnel that would lead them out. So if they went even like slightly above, they would have gone into the third chamber. Does that make sense?
Wow. So like the passage to no man's land and where they came from was right next to each other.
Right next to each other, yes. And visibility was zero. And there was literally no light except from their headlamps, which they couldn't see anything because, like I said, visibility was zero. So
if they... And there's no ropes?
You know, I don't actually know if this cave had ropes or not, but I haven't seen any mention of ropes. So it's possible that it didn't have ropes, or maybe there were ropes leading into both of the chambers, potentially. But they had zero visibility, and so four of them ended up going up into the third cavern, and the diving instructor is believed to have just gone back out the way they came. Either that was luck, or he genuinely knew which way he was going. It's unclear, but four of them ended up into the third chamber, and that's where they died.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly sad, because when they made it up into the third chamber, they would have seen that the way they had gone actually led to a dead end and not out to safety. And it was then that they very likely panicked, which used up all of their gas, which was made even worse by the fact that they were 50 to 60 meters underwater. Every second spent attempting to correct their mistake only made the situation worse until it was ultimately too late. So a lot of people were saying these divers likely made a reckless mistake in the cave by going deeper, but it was more likely that the darkness, silt, stress, and disorientation just made the wrong tunnel look like the correct exit. Because in the beginning of this story coming out, people were like, oh, these stupid divers, they went too deep. But it's like, no, they just got turned around and like disoriented. At least yeah. That's the theory.
I mean, is now the time?
No, probably not, but the internet's a hellscape.
I know.
So.
It's like these people just died, you know?
Well, yeah.
Now we're going to be calling them stupid?
Well, it was kind of like the first story where they're like, oh, hubris, you know? They thought they were so experienced and they could handle it, but in reality.
I get it, but it's still a tragedy.
Oh, I mean, like, what?
What is to be gained
by
calling them stupid? It's just a dangerous thing to do.
Yep. A member of the diving team that recovered the bodies of the five Italian scuba divers said their equipment was not optimal. Four of the divers' bodies were found together in the cave 164 feet underwater, and the divers died just 15 minutes from reaching the surface, is how it was reported. So I guess if they went the right way and they made their essential decompression stops, it would have taken them 15 minutes to get out. One of the Finnish divers told Italian media it was quote-unquote tragic human error. That was the main reason for their death. But there's been a bunch of like investigations into why this dive even happened, because it seems like they went way deeper than they should have, and also like there was no real reason for them to be in this cave. But like I said earlier, it's believed that this one was just kind of like a recreational dive for them, and it wasn't necessarily for any mission. But the incident has renewed warnings from experts about the risks of cave diving without proper training, planning, and specialized equipment.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to play games 160 feet in a cave in the ocean.
No.
In a current.
Right. Jonathan Valanthan, one of the British cave divers who helped rescue 12 schoolboys from a flooded cave in Thailand in 2018, which we have talked about, says cave diving carries risks fundamentally different from open water diving. Divers cannot make a direct ascent in an emergency, which is huge. And he said, quote, if something goes wrong, you can't simply head to the surface because there's usually something that's preventing that. Quite often in caves as well, it's very easy to swim in somewhere and then find you stirred some silt up. The combination of not being able to ascend to the surface and poor visibility makes exit much more difficult if a diver hits trouble. He said, quote, the deeper you are, the more air you use, or the more gas, depending on what you're breathing, depth generally equals an increase in danger. He also said, quote, caves are not dark. Everybody thinks they're dark. They're devoid of light. Your house at night is dark. When your light goes out in a cave, there's nothing. You don't see a reflection. Your eyes don't get used to it. And as a result, divers can lose track of all spatial awareness. That's why we learn to always have a continuous guideline to the surface. And so that's why it's so important to like actually follow the regulations and safety measures in place. So cave diving is incredibly dangerous, but also I've seen a lot of people be like, cave diving is safe, but also it's safe if you know what you're doing and you have the proper equipment and nothing goes wrong.
Sure.
Can you see now why, as I was researching, I had chest pain?
Oh yeah. I mean, The phrase devoid of light is a real one. I don't know. Have you ever like truly experienced like a true complete darkness?
I don't think so. I mean, I've been in very dark places, but truly devoid of light as in like a cave underwater? Probably not. Like, I think I can understand what that means, but like to be actually in it is probably different than like what you think.
Right. I guess I don't think I really have. The closest thing that I can remember is being out on the open ocean at night.
Oh, sure.
And you look down off the cruise ship and you literally cannot see the water.
Oh, yeah.
You just see a lack of light.
Sure. Yeah. I've seen that.
Like, just imagine that all around.
All around. Yeah. And then also imagine you can't actually communicate with anyone with words. You can only use hand signals to...
Or touch.
Or touch, but you can't see anything at all. Like, and not because you don't have like a lamp, but because the silt that gets kicked up with the wrong like kick of a fin is everywhere. And then your visual goes to zero as well. So you can't communicate with anyone. You just have to kind of go in a single direction, but that direction could be wrong.
Yeah. If you're going to do it right. It's still so sad for these people.
It is very
gone
sad.
Too soon.
I agree. Yeah. And it was like a mother and her daughter. Like that really sucks. Ugh. It kind of reminds me of like the Titan, you know? It was this guy who brought his son down there.
I don't remember that one.
The not submarine, but the thing that like exploded at the
Oh my god. Yeah. You remember that? It wasn't a submarine, you're right, but they were like doing a
submersible.
Trip. Yeah.
It was a submersible. They were going to the Titanic.
Yeah, and it just freaking gave up and sank to the bottom of the ocean, dude.
No, it didn't. It completely eviscerated them. It didn't sink to the bottom. They literally got sent into a pulp.
Right, but they lost the ability to go back up, so they just kept going down, and then they...
Yeah, the pressure or something got too great. But yeah, my point is that there was a guy who brought his son into that, and now it's a similar... Anyway, it's bad. It's really bad. Hey, guys, sorry about this episode. Maybe we'll do better next week.
Yeah, this one got dark in more ways than one.
Right.
I don't know. I really have nothing else to say.
Hey, you know what? That's okay. Why don't we move on to something different and we can talk about something good? Because we use our good things as a way to clear the air, cleanse the palate, if you will. It has nothing to do with what we've just talked about, and we'll just chat about something else. So what's your good thing?
Sometimes the transition is rough.
And sometimes transitions are hard. And sometimes words are hard. What's your good thing?
Yeah. My good thing is that I recently played one of the best rounds of 9 holes I have ever played.
Right. Hello, golf.
Golf has now entered the chat of the good things, but I shot 2 under on 9. For those of you who understand what that is, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
For those of you who don't, that's really good. I played really well and I won some money, and that is my good thing.
Hey, we love winning some money.
Love it. So what's your good thing?
My good thing is that I officiated some of our best friend's wedding a few days ago.
And it was lovely.
Yeah, it was lovely. Our best friends got married and I got to have a really cool view and say some words.
You did say the words. You said them well.
I said some words and they smooched, and so it is done.
So it is done.
And so it shall be.
That's what you said.
Yeah, exactly. And then we danced a lot and had so many old fashions that the venue was like, oh, we've been warned that we should have old fashions batched. And so we have a pitcher of old fashions. And I said,
truly crazy.
Hell yeah. So that's what I did this weekend. And,
and you go, that's cute. You thought we only needed one.
Honestly, they ran out pretty quick. Like, not even joking. Because everyone was drinking them. So they ended up actually having to mix every other old fashioned, which I guess the pitcher helped them some, but not all night. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to check out our Patreon, head over to patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. I have my second YouTube video out now and currently working on the third. So if you want to see my face and hear me yap about other stuff, head over to Steph Today over on YouTube. I post pictures of all the stories we talk about over on Instagram at nottoday_podcast. I am genuinely catching up right now. So you'll see the pictures for our episodes that are recent soon. We have a TikTok, that is not today podcast, and a Twitter, that is not today podcast, with a T on that podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.